Let me just create a hypothetical situation. You know the sort of situation that I'm going to describe, or something similar. Things are generally going well, you're quite carefree, and you've had this vacation planned for months. If it's my vacation, you're driving to the Oregon coast. You just clocked out of work, the car is loaded, and you're on the road. Everything's beautiful when you're in this sort of zone, when you have a great destination. Everything's beautiful. The clouds are extra shiny and white. The mountains look majestic. And the coast, if that's where you're going, is just beyond belief. So you finally make it to Highway 101. Just visited Ripley's, believe it or not, in Oregon. Because how can you not? In Newport, how can you not? But the shopkeepers are extra friendly and the seafood is a little bit more delicious than normal. Holistically, everything is great. Until something goes wrong. Maybe you get a flat tire. Or slightly more serious, you hurt yourself and you have to go to the local urgent care. Or you get a phone call from home with really bad news. And suddenly, this great, big, beautiful world evaporates and all that's left is your problem right in front of you. That's all you can see. Can't see past your trials, can't see past your problems, and you desperately want answers and assurance, and you want them now. The world went from being enormous and beautiful to irrelevant in the face of what you are up against. Seems like nothing can move forward. Though we would all normally admit that God can and does overcome any and every obstacle, the words don't come as easy when trial and tribulation hit close to home. How can things progress when there's cancer? How can His kingdom truly come when there's so much unbelief? When a church is shrinking, God, are you really in this? When families are torn apart, how can we move forward? We have a lot to cover, so I'm going to jump straight to my proposition today. It's this: do you trust God to carry on His mission despite trial and tribulation? Do you trust God to carry on His mission despite trial and tribulation? And today, I want to pause and pray. Would you pray with me? God in heaven, I come before you today desperately in need of your help, desperately dependent upon you to move today. Would you speak through your word today in a way that makes much of Jesus? I pray that we would be stretched where we need to be stretched. We would be reminded of what we've always known where we need to be reminded of what we've always known. And that we would walk away with a bigger picture of who you are and what you're doing. Accomplish this by your Holy Spirit, I pray. Amen. Now, this passage has real truth for us to see, to bring into our hearts, and to change the way we live today. It does, and we're going to get to that truth. However, this passage also presents what I might call a unique challenge. This passage has often been cited and used as describing a time and series of events that I don't believe it describes. Let me be very upfront about this, and I ask you to save either your applause or your throwing of vegetables till the end. Many people look to Matthew chapter 24, especially verses 1 through 35, which is today's sermon, verses 1 through 35. Many people look to these verses as descriptive of the end of time, when Jesus returns to make all things new. I do not believe that is the case. I believe this text is describing the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Verse 36 and following, I believe, is clearly describing the second coming of Jesus at the end of time. But that's my next sermon, so I don't want to get ahead of myself. So either this passage that we're about to read, it was either immediately applicable to the disciples, or it wasn't. And that difference will determine quite a bit in the meaning. So as we go, and as we find the meaning in this text, I'm going to give a lot of effort to showing you why I believe these words pertained to the disciples directly in their time and place. Please give me that chance. Why the trial and tribulation described applies to them. And then what meaning we can draw out for ourselves from that, okay? Do you trust God to carry on His mission despite trial and tribulation? The disciples faced trial and tribulation, as we will see. Let's begin with the claim of Jesus. My first point, the claim of Jesus. Verses 1 and 2, chapter 24. Jesus left the temple and was going away when His disciples came to point out to Him the buildings of the temple. But He answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Okay, Jesus just finished, if you remember, He just finished His woes against the Pharisees and scribes, and now it's just Him and the disciples. And as they're leaving the temple, this happens. The disciples point back, they point out the temple buildings. Wow, aren't they great? Aren't they really something? Jesus says, "Not a single stone will be left standing where this temple is now." Is that enough to make a first century Jew nervous? Yes, you bet it is. It absolutely is. The temple is everything. This is what distinguishes them from all other nations. This is where sacrifice happens. How are we supposed to move forward when this grand system that has been so integral to our lives is going away? What a big claim Jesus just made. The temple is going away. That's the claim that begins this entire discussion, the next two chapters, chapter 24, 25, what's known as the Olivet Discourse, meaning Jesus gave it at the top of the Mount of Olives. The next two chapters start with that claim. The temple will be destroyed, Jesus said, and it was. Josephus recounts this event in chapter after chapter of his book entitled The Jewish Wars. Down to the gritty details, he tells us how the Romans set fire to the temple and burned it systematically over the course of days. It all really happened in time and space, and Jesus mentions the event here. And in response to that claim, the disciples ask two questions. Two questions. Look at verse 3. As He sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to Him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of Your coming and of the end of the age?" You say the temple is going down. We have a couple questions. Question one, when will these things happen, the destruction of the temple? And two, what will be the sign of Your coming and of the end of the age? When will the temple be destroyed, and when will You return? I think those are two very appropriate questions based off of what they just heard. The epicenter of their faith for generations is about to be pulled out from under them, and they are bothered by that, understandably. Okay, when is that happening, and when will You return? I imagine two hunters. One falls and sprains his ankle, cannot walk. And the other hunter says, "Okay, here's what we'll do. I'm taking the gun, and I'm going to walk out of here and get help. I'll be back sometime. Oh, by the way, this is really dense bear country, so just know that." The guy being left there might have some questions. When is sundown? When will You be back? Do you have to take the gun? The disciples ask two questions, and they get two answers. But only one for today. We're going to talk about the answer to the first question today. Today we look at Jesus' answer to the question, when will the event that you just mentioned, the temple being destroyed, take place? And so now let's read the remainder of the text. I'm just going to read it, verses 4 through 35. This is Jesus' answer. Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight might not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Well, there's your answer. Any questions? This is the answer to the question, and it will serve us to consider the answer a bit more closely. Am I having microphone issues or what? You hear them? That's not just in my head. You hear that? Okay. Let me try something. Okay, let's try this. It will serve us to consider his answer a bit more closely. So here's my third and the longest point, the details. Now, this text that I just read, maybe you're thinking as I read it, this has got to be about the second coming of Jesus, right? I mean, come on. Who are you kidding? Look at what is mentioned. Wars, famine, false messiahs. I think I even heard the word tribulation in there. I don't think so. Now, I don't think so for three reasons, and this is what I'd like the opportunity to flesh out. Now, first, the disciples asked their questions in order, and Jesus answered in order. The first question was about the temple, so the first answer is about the temple. That's the first reason I think we need to read this with a first century lens. The second reason is verse 34. I hope you noticed verse 34 as we were reading. Because after describing all of these events, Jesus says this in verse 34. He says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." Now, when Matthew uses the word generation in his gospel, which he does multiple times, it always means the simplest understanding of a generation. These are the generations of Jesus Christ, and then we get his genealogy. Generation means generation in the gospel according to Matthew. I think that if we want this text to apply to thousands of years in the future, we will get hung up on verse 34, which says that everything just described will be observable in the first century. But my third reason is the testimony of history. These details that I just read match actual events in the first century. And that's what I'd like to show you. Now, here's a disclaimer. This is going to come across largely as a history lesson, and I could not think of a better way to present it. This is quite a unique sermon. I could not think of a better way to present it, so please bear with me, and I hope that through these details of history, you see that this did pertain directly to the disciples and was directly applicable to them in their time and place. Will they trust God in their trials and tribulations, and will we? Details that make me tend to believe these events happened in the first century. Here we go. The repeated use of the word "you." Verse 6. "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars." Verse 9. "They will deliver you up and they will put you to death. And you will be hated by all." Verse 15. "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel." Jesus is not talking to himself as a soliloquy out loud, and he is not speaking in a vacuum. He is talking to the disciples. They asked a question, they are getting an answer. When you experience this, when this happens to you and your generation. Okay, granted, it may seem like he's talking to the 12, but what about these other things? False messiahs, earthquakes, wars. Okay, false messiahs. There were many false messiahs in the first century between AD 33 and AD 70. There were. Luke tells us about Simon Magus in Acts 8, verses 9 through 10. Justin Martyr, the early historian, tells us after Christ's ascension into heaven, the devils put forward certain men who said they themselves were gods. First century historian and Jewish eyewitness Josephus expounds upon this. Listen, he says, "There was also another body of wicked men gotten together, not so impure in their actions, but more wicked in their intentions, who laid waste the happy state of the city, no less than did these murderers. These were such men as deceived and deluded the people under the pretense of divine inspiration, but were for procuring innovations and changes of the government. And these prevailed with the multitude to act like madmen, and went before them into the wilderness, as pretending that God would there show them the signals of liberty." In the very next section in Josephus' same work, The Jewish Wars, he describes a man called the Egyptian false prophet, who led 30,000 people. 30,000 people from the wilderness up and over the Mount of Olives, where Jesus gave this teaching, down to the walls of Jerusalem to attempt to break in and control it, all under the pretense that he was a false Messiah. That happened. Consider the warnings to real life first century churches against false messiahs and false prophets. You can read all about them in Galatians, 2 Corinthians, Colossians, 2 Peter, Acts, Romans, and 1 John. The testimony of history within and outside the Bible is that false messiahs were prevalent in the first century in Israel. So I think that fits. What about wars and rumors of wars in verse 6? Historians observe relative peace in Israel from roughly the birth of Jesus right up until the time before Nero. And that's when things really started falling apart. Consider these historical events. Between years 33 and 70, here are a few wars and rumors of wars that concerned the Jewish people. There was an uprising in Caesarea that killed 20,000 Jews. There was a revolt in Scythopolis that left 13,000 Jews dead. In Alexandria, 50,000 were killed. 10,000 killed in Damascus. All of this in the correct time frame. The emperor Caligula wanted his statue built in the Jewish temple in AD 40. The Jews refused. So from that point forward, there was constant anxiety and tension over the possibility or rumor of war with Rome, because they had spurned the very emperor. And that's just in the more immediate area. Tacitus tells us about global wars going on at the same time in Africa, Thrace, Gaul, modern-day Germany, and Armenia. The world was very much at unrest, both at home and abroad. More specifically, though, the Jewish war with Rome began in AD 67. During a brief break in that war, there was a Jewish civil war. And in the years 68 to 69, there were the Roman civil wars. The year of four emperors was considered extremely violent and war-torn. So considering a first century Jewish setting, wars and rumors of wars fits perfectly. What about famine and earthquakes? Acts 11:28 speaks of the famine that Agabus prophesied. Outside the Bible, Josephus tells us about local famines in his book called Antiquities of the Jews and in his book The Jewish Wars. There were three famines alone during the reign of Claudius. Acts 16 records an earthquake. More than that, though, Crete, Smyrna, Miletus, Chios, Samos, Apamea, Campania, Rome, Laodicea, Hierapolis, and Colossae were all devastated by an earthquake in AD 60, affecting the entire Roman world by way of trade and commerce. Famine and earthquakes fits the setting. And all these things, Jesus says, serve as signs. Jesus is telling them the signs that will come before Jerusalem falls. Lord, when will these things happen? I will tell you. He tells them exactly what to expect and anticipate as the day approaches. His second coming at the end of the age, he says no sign will be given. No one knows that day. But you get signs for this day. Verse 8 says, all these are but the beginning of the birth pains. These signs are not the end, but they are simply the beginning of the end for Jerusalem and specifically the temple. Verses 9 through 13 describes the discord that will take place among the people, hating and betraying one another. I would also commend to you on this point the Jewish Wars by Josephus, who again was witness to the events. The story is full of usurpers and backstabbing and treachery and power grabbing in Jerusalem. Listen to this quote. This is Sam Storms summarizing Josephus' comments on this. He says, Jerusalem, that last Jewish stronghold, was the focus of Rome's most brutal rage. Multitudes of thieves, zealots, and murderers had flocked to the city seeking refuge. The city was without law and order. Chaos and anarchy reigned. The city divided into warring factions who took turns attacking each other. In one incident, more than 12,000 of the city's nobles and leading citizens were tortured and killed by the zealots. Those who tried to escape had their throats slit and their bodies were left to rot in the streets. Burial became impossible. Huge piles of cadavers filled the streets or were thrown from the city's walls. And while all this is going on, the infant church will suffer. The disciples in the early church will be persecuted all over Israel, even put to death. Last chapter we read from Jesus that his people will be persecuted from town to town. But now you say, so far so good, but what about verse 14? It seems to clearly say that the gospel has to be proclaimed to the entire world before the end. Surely this is talking about the return of Jesus, not the fall of Jerusalem. Well, let's talk about this global gospel proclamation. I think it would be extremely helpful to point out that the word world here and most of the New Testament is most accurately translated as the whole inhabited world or the whole known world. Let's jump forward to Pentecost for a moment. When the Holy Spirit is poured out upon the church to go forward in powerful witness, Acts 2 says that men were present, devout men from every nation under heaven. Every nation. That's amazing. I didn't realize there were Jamaicans and Australians and Estonians there. That's phenomenal. But the text actually clarifies in verse 9. Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome. That doesn't sound like every nation. Often in the New Testament, world means the Roman world. The known or inhabited world. You see this more in Luke 2, Acts 11, Acts 24, Colossians 1, Romans 1, and Romans 10. A decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Same use of the word. We are not talking about everything we see when the Universal Studios logo comes out and begins our movie. We are talking about the known inhabited Roman world, the world that was most relevant to this first century Jewish context. And through Pentecost and through God working through the first century church, the known Roman world did hear the gospel proclaimed in these men's generation, starting with the national representatives present at Pentecost. Church history tells us that by the time Thomas died, he had made his way halfway across India. But what about this abomination of desolation? Oh, it just reeks of end times, doesn't it? That's got end times written all over it. Literally, it is an abomination that causes desolation. That's what it is. Let's read verse 15 again. Look at verse 15. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Pause. Let the reader understand. Understand what? Well, Jesus just told us. Understand Daniel. This is written of in the book of Daniel. So let the reader of Daniel understand. And what did Daniel say? Daniel said in Daniel chapter 9 that God's anointed would be cut off, the city and sanctuary would be destroyed, sacrifice and offering will be ended, and Jesus is here saying, remember what Daniel said? This is what he was talking about. The time of the end of Jerusalem and the temple as a religious system. Something abominable happening in the holy place. Did anything abominable by Jewish standards happen in the holy place in the first century? Indisputably, yes. In AD 70, the Roman general Titus and his armies surrounded the city, which Luke 21 tells us is the beginning of the desolation. They set fire to it and to the temple, and then they entered the temple, and here is what they did, says Josephus. And now the Romans, upon the flight of the seditious into the city, and upon the burning of the holy house itself, and of all the buildings round about it, they brought their ensigns into the temple and set them over against its eastern gate, and there they did offer sacrifices to them. And there they did make Titus imperator with the greatest acclamations of joy. Consider how abominable this was from a Jewish perspective. Gentiles or non-Jews were not allowed far into the temple. They were considered extremely unclean and could only enter the outer court of the temple but come no closer. These non-Jews came right into the middle, burning as they went. More than that, though, they set up their ensigns or their symbolic religious emblems and flags in the temple. More than setting them up, though, they offered pagan sacrifice to the ensigns in the temple. This is an abomination, followed by desolation. Jesus said last chapter regarding the temple, do you remember? Your house is left to you desolate. This event, the abomination of desolation, took place in Jerusalem in AD 70. And when it happens, Jesus said, emphasizing that this was a local event, those in Judea will flee to the mountains and flee quickly, as the next several verses emphasize. It's not a good time to linger. Now, I am well aware of the ideas about the end times that have been popularized by this passage and others. I'm aware of the various movies and books that take these events and attempt to cast them thousands of years into the future. I'm aware. I would wager that many of us have had exposure to or experience with those books and movies and blogs, so on and so forth. So, take a deep breath. Please, let this text challenge you. Let this sermon and this text force your nose back into your scriptures. That's always a good thing. These things were applicable to the generation living in the first century. And that's not my speculation. Those are Jesus' words. He said this is for this generation. So be stretched by this passage and consider it carefully. And thank you for hanging with me through this history lesson. We're almost through it. And I hope we will be served by taking this time to look closely at this passage. So up through verse 26, false messiahs are mentioned again. We already looked at the historical reality of those false messiahs. Don't believe it. It isn't me. Jesus says, you'll know when it's me. You'll know when it's me. Just like lightning flashing in the sky that you can see from the next state over, you'll know when it's me. Like when you see vultures circling and you can see it from a distance, yeah, you'll know when it's me. These guys aren't me. You'll know when it's me. Verses 29 through 31 talk about tribulation. And surely there is no way this applies to the first century. Can't. It mentions the sun and the moon going black. It mentions the stars falling, the heavens being shaken. That has got to be talking about the second coming of Jesus, right? Well, let me remind you again of verse 34. This generation will not pass away until all these things take place. That's our time stamp. Let's consider these items in a first century setting. So put simply, my friends, the testimony of Scripture is that the language used here is meant to be understood as repeating Old Testament language for divine judgment. So, okay, we've seen this language before in Scripture, is my point. So we let the Bible interpret the Bible. That's kind of a major principle of reading the Bible. You let it interpret itself. We've seen this language before. So consider with me a couple of Old Testament passages that use this same kind of judgment language. Language referring to events that have already taken place at the time Jesus uses the language. So consider this. Isaiah, speaking of the historic event of the fall of Babylon, which actually happened, says this: the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. That sounds familiar. That was referring to the actual fall of Babylon when Persia came in, word up, and conquered Babylon. What about this judgment on Edom? Their slain shall be cast out, and the stench of their corpses shall rise. The mountains shall flow with their blood. All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall, and leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. For my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I have devoted to destruction. Friends, that happened, and frankly, all of the cosmos did not rot away to nothing. Otherwise, we would not be here. What about the Jewish exile that was coming? Jeremiah said this, "I looked on the earth, and behold, it was without form and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and beheld, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro." Ezekiel 5, Joel 2, Ezekiel 32, they all use this same imagery to depict God's judgment on a nation. So this is common judgment language, is what I'm trying to show you. Jesus is employing what the disciples have already read and what they already know. Old Testament language using powerful images to depict coming judgment. What is the result of this judgment? Again, thank you for bearing with me through that long history lesson. I realize that this passage is unique. And now we're getting back to my proposition. The question, do you trust God to carry on His mission despite trial and tribulation? The disciples are given great reason to trust Jesus despite trial and tribulation. Look at what God has planned in and through this judgment. This is my last point. It's the result. The result. What is the result of this judgment? Let me read again verses 29 through 31. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And He will send out His angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather His elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Is this guy, referring to myself, I'm thinking for you, is this guy really going to make the case that this applies to the first century? He is. The Son of Man comes in on the clouds in great glory. Now that's Jesus coming back at the end of time, right? No, let me explain briefly. This wasn't a brand new phrase when Jesus says it right here. That's not the first time it's being used. In fact, the Son of Man coming on the clouds is an old expression at the time Jesus said it. It's a quote. Jesus is quoting, no surprise again, the prophet Daniel. From Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel chapter 7, which he's quoting, we read this. "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man." And he's coming at the end of time? No, he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, one that shall not be destroyed. Brothers and sisters, the Son of Man coming with the clouds is not a reference to the return of Jesus at the end of time, but to the ascension of Jesus after his resurrection. He was presented before the Ancient of Days, and the Ancient of Days was pleased with him and gave him dominion. This is Revelation 5. Who is worthy to take and open the scroll? Only the Lamb who was just slain. This is Matthew 28. All authority has been given to me. This is Psalm 110. "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." You've got all authority. You've got all dominion. This judgment then is not connected with the wrapping up of all things at the end of time, but is connected with the current authority and reign of Jesus as he builds his kingdom and removes all obstacles to ensure the success of his kingdom. Connected with his ascension and his current rule, then, we can better understand verse 31. "He will send out his angels," or literally his messengers. "He will send out his messengers, and they will gather his elect from the four winds all over creation." Brothers and sisters, this is happening right now. This is why you are in this room and professing Christ, if you do. Because he is sending his messengers, and the elect are being gathered from all corners of the earth. Because Jesus has been victorious through his sacrifice and resurrection. because he has appeared before the Father, the Ancient of Days, and he has been found worthy. He has been given dominion. He has been given authority to build his kingdom across barriers and borders and all around the world through time. And it started right here with the first persecutors of the church being decimated by judgment so that God's plan could march forward. He has all authority. That's what the Son of Man coming on the clouds to the Ancient of Days means. Do not lose heart, disciples. The temple will fall. Jerusalem will burn. Everything you've ever known will change. But even so, the Father's will be done in his perfect plan and perfect time. Do you trust him? Yeah. What a long history lesson. I feel like we should take a test. Friends, I ask you today, do you trust him? Because here's the deal. We aren't like the disciples. Here's what I mean. They were given the details of what was coming in their generation. These things will happen before judgment comes. Count on it. We don't get that. He has yet to do that for me when I'm entering into a hard season of uncertainty. He doesn't give me a sermon from the Mount of Olives explaining where the finances will come from or whether or not the chemo will work. He doesn't give those answers. God doesn't always give us what we want to know, but he gives us Jesus. You know, I want us to end here. He gives us Jesus. He gives us a Savior in whom we can trust and be assured for eternity. We get the same Jesus who promised his kingdom victory from the Mount of Olives 2,000 years ago. We get the same Jesus. We get the same Jesus who ascended on high to the Father and was found worthy and who was given authority to build his church. We get him. And what he has promised to his disciples, that he would be victorious and that he would bring good to his people, he still promises that to us, his church. Now the promises of trial and destruction in Matthew 24, they did indeed come. But his kingdom marched on past 70 AD, through the centuries, and right to this week in Bozeman. It marched on past the trial and tribulation. And there is nothing we can face that God doesn't know. There is no trial that can stop his purposes. There is no political upheaval, natural disaster, war, or rumor of war that will slow down the plans and purposes of God through Jesus. Do you trust him? Let this text serve you today by the glimpse of God that it gives you. This is a God with a plan. This is a God with a purpose. This is a God who guarantees victory through his Son. That victory has come through the one who was slain for the sins of people who can now be reconciled to God on high. It comes through Jesus Christ. And he calls us to trust his finished work on our behalf so that we might be numbered in that kingdom for now and all time. Would you please pray with me?